The mystery of the Black Dahlia is probably one of the most well-known unsolved mysteries of the 20th century. I'm Felicia Huffman, and this is Macabre Midnight.
Welcome back.
Hi!
Leslie and Lucas is with us. It's been a while.
Yeah.
All right, so for the next 2 weeks, we'll be discussing the Black Dahlia. Tonight, we'll go over the murder, and then next time, we will dive into the suspected killers. Y'all have anything to say before I jump into this?
I'm excited. This is a big case.
I just hope my research lives up to his excitement. Despite the fact that this murder has never been solved, a number of people have come up with a lot of theories about what could have happened to this young woman. And we'll talk about that next week. In Boston, Massachusetts, on July 29th, 1924, Elizabeth Short was born to Cleo and Phoebe Short. She was the third of five daughters. Short's father built miniature golf courses until the stock market crash of 1929. That is when he lost most of his savings. In 1930, her father's car was discovered abandoned on the Charlestown Bridge. It was assumed that he had jumped into the Charles River. Since she believed her husband to be dead, Elizabeth's mother moved with her five daughters into a small apartment in Medford and worked as a bookkeeper. Elizabeth had suffered from severe asthma and bronchitis much of her life, and at the age of 15, she underwent lung surgery. After that, the doctor suggested that she would do better if she lived in a milder climate during the winter to prevent further respiratory problems. Her mother sent her to live in Miami, Florida, and with some family and friends during the winter months. Over the next 3 years, Elizabeth would live in Florida during the winter and spent the rest of her life in Medford with her family. She dropped out of high school during her sophomore year. In late 1942, Short's mother got an apology letter from her presumed deceased husband, which revealed that he was alive and well and had begun a new life in California. When she turned 18, Elizabeth moved to Vallejo to live with her father, whom she had not seen since she was six. She and her father did not get along very well, and the arguments between them led to her moving out in January 1943, a month after she moved in. After this, she got a job at the base exchange at Camp Cook and would live with friends. At one point, it's believed she lived with an Army Armed Force sergeant who reportedly abused her. Elizabeth left this area in mid-1943 and moved to Santa Barbara. She was arrested on September 23rd for underage drinking. The authorities sent her back to Medford, but she went to Florida instead and would only make occasional visits to Massachusetts. While in Florida, Elizabeth met Major Matthew Michael Gordon, Jr., who was a decorated Army Armed Force officer and was training for deployment to the China-Burma-India Theater of Operations in World War II. Elizabeth had told her friends that Gordon had written to her and proposed marriage while he was recovering from injuries he had sustained in a plane crash. She accepted, but he died in a second crash on August 10, 1945, less than a week before Japan surrendered, which would end the war. She moved back to California, this time to Los Angeles, in July 1946. This time she was visiting Army Air Force Lieutenant Joseph Gordon Fickling, whom she had met in Florida. Fickling had been stationed at the Naval Reserve Air Base in Long Beach. Elizabeth would spend the final 6 months of her life in Southern California. She mainly stayed in Los Angeles, and shortly before she was murdered, she had been working as a waitress and was renting a room behind the Florentine Gardens nightclub. Elizabeth has often been described as an aspiring actress, and a number of sources said she did have aspirations to become a film star, but she never had any known roles. Not every piece of Elizabeth's life is known, which is a big reason why her murder has not been solved. However, on January 9th, 1947, Elizabeth was returning to her home in L.A. after taking a brief trip to San Diego with Robert Manley, a 25-year-old married salesman she had been seeing. Manley said that he had dropped her off at the Biltmore Hotel at 506 South Grand Avenue in downtown L.A., and that she was going to meet up with her sister who was visiting from Boston. Some staff members at the hotel said that they saw her using the lobby telephone. Shortly after, it has been alleged that she was at the Crown Grill Cocktail Lounge at 754 South Olive Street which was almost a half mile away from the Biltmore Hotel. On the morning of January 15, 1947, Elizabeth's naked body was discovered severed in half on a vacant lot on the west side of South Norton Avenue, at the halfway point between West 39th and Coliseum Street and Limert Park. During this time, the neighborhood was pretty much undeveloped. Betty Bursinger, a local, found the body at around 10 a.m. as she was walking her three-year-old daughter. Bursinger thought she had found a discarded mannequin. Once she realized that it was a corpse, she rushed to a nearby house and called the police. Elizabeth's mutilated body was completely cut at the waist and had been drained of blood, leaving her skin pallid white. The ME determined that she had likely been dead for about 10 hours before she was found, leaving her time of death at either sometime during the evening of January 14th or the early morning hours of the 15th. It appears as though the body had been washed by the killer. Her face had been slashed from the corners of her mouth up to her ears, creating what is known as the Glasgow smile. There were several cuts all over her breasts and thighs, and there were entire portions of her flesh that were sliced away completely. The lower half of the body had been placed a foot from the upper, and her intestines were tucked under her buttocks. The corpse was posed with her hands over her head, her elbows bent at right angles, and her legs spread. After she was discovered, a crowd of people and reporters started to gather. Aggie Underwood, a reporter for the Los Angeles Herald Express, was one of the first to arrive at the scene and took photos of the crime scene and corpse. Close to the body, detectives found a heel print close to some tire tracks. There were cement stacks containing watery blood close by. The coroner, Frederick Newbar, performed an autopsy on the 16th. His report stated that Elizabeth was 5 feet 5 inches tall, weighing 115 pounds, had light blue eyes, brown hair, and badly decayed teeth. She had ligature marks on her neck, ankles, and wrists, and he noticed an irregular laceration with superficial tissue loss on the right breast. Newbar also found superficial lacerations on the lower half side of the chest, left upper arm, and right forearm. The killer had sliced the body in half using a technique that had been taught in the 1930s known as a hemicorporectomy. They had removed the lower half by transecting the lumbar spine between the second and third lumbar vertebrae, which meant that the intestine was severed at the duodenum. Newmore did not find a lot of bruising along the incision, which meant that this had been done after death. There was another gaping laceration that was 4.25 inches long that ran longitudinal from the belly button to the suprapubic region. The cuts to the face, which extended from the corners of the mouth, were 3 inches long at the right side and 2.5 on the left. The skull hadn't been fractured, but there was bruising on the right and front of the scalp, with some bleeding at the right of the head that was consistent with a blow to the head. The cause of death was said to be hemorrhaging from the lacerations to the face and the shock caused from the blows to the head and face. He also found that her anal canal was dilated, which meant that she might have been raped. They took samples to test for sperm, but it came back negative.
At least they tested for sperm. At least they actually tried.
Yeah.
That's so much better than the other cases we have discussed.
Yeah.
Class. Episode. Series? What do you call it?
Podcast.
Yeah, there you go. That's the word I'm looking for.
Podcast.
They identified Elizabeth through her fingerprints when they sent them to the FBI via sound photo. Her arrest from 1943 helped to identify her. Right after she had been identified, reporters from the Examiner contacted her mother and told her that her daughter had won a beauty contest. Only after he had pried as much personal information as he could from Phoebe, the reporter revealed that Elizabeth had in fact been murdered. The newspaper offered to pay for her accommodations and airfare so that she could come to L.A. to help with the investigation. That was just another ploy, since the newspaper worked hard to keep her from the police and any other reporters to protect their story. Other papers owned by William Randolph Hearst sensationalized the case with an article describing the black tailored suit Elizabeth had last been seen in as a tight skirt and a sheer blouse. The media quickly nicknamed her the Black Dahlia, and they said she was an adventurous who would prowl Hollywood Boulevard. There were other reports that deemed the murder a sex fiend slaying. During their initial investigation, there was a person who called the office of James Richardson on January 21st, claiming to be the killer. The caller told Richardson that he should be on the lookout for souvenirs from the murder. Then, on January 24th, a suspicious envelope was found by a postal worker. It was addressed to the Los Angeles Examiner and other papers in the area. It had individual words that were cut and pasted from a newspaper, plus a large message on the face of the envelope that said, quote, "Here is Dahlia's belongings, letter to follow." In the envelope was Elizabeth's birth certificate, business cards, photographs, names written on pieces of paper, and an address book with the name Mark Hansen embossed on the cover. They had carefully cleaned the package with gasoline, which was similar to how the body had been cleaned. This made the police believe that the packet had been sent by the killer. Despite their best efforts to clean the packet, there was a number of partial fingerprints lifted off the envelope and sent to the FBI. However, those prints were compromised during transit.
Never mind. I just bragged about this. Now I'm just like, how?
I don't know. That same day, a black suede shoe and a handbag was reported to have been seen on top of a garbage can in an alley a short distance from Norton Avenue, 2 miles from where Elizabeth's body had been found. The police recovered the items, but they had also been cleaned with gasoline. On March 14th, there was a suicide note written in pencil on a piece of paper found tucked in a shoe in a pile of men's clothes at the edge of the ocean on Breeze Avenue. The note said, quote, "To whom it may concern, I have waited for the police to capture me for the Black Dahlia killing, but have not. I am too much of a coward to turn myself in, so this is the best way out for me. I couldn't help myself for that or this. Sorry, Mary." End quote. The clothes included a coat and trousers made of blue herringbone tweed, a brown and white Y shirt, white jockey shorts, tan socks, and tan moccasin leisure shoes, size about 8. The clothes didn't provide any clues as to their owner. During the initial stages, 750 investigators from the LAPD and other departments worked on the case. They searched storm drains, abandoned structures, and various sites all along the LA River, but their searches didn't find anything. Lloyd G. David, a city councilman, posted a $10,000 reward for information that led to the killer. Of course, this only got them a bunch of false confessions. Many of these people were charged with obstruction of justice. Another letter was received by the Examiner on January 26th, and it was handwritten this time. It read, quote, "Here it is. Turning in Wednesday, January 29th, 10 a.m. Had my fun at police. Black Dahlia Avenger." End quote. The letter also gave a location where the killer was supposed to go and turn himself in. The police waited, but the killer didn't show. Instead, at 1 p.m., the examiner's office got another cut and pasted letter that said, quote, "Have changed my mind. You would not give me a square deal. Dahlia killing was justified." End quote. The graphic nature of the crime and the letters had resulted in a media frenzy. National and local publications covered the story heavily, many of which sensationalized the story, saying that Elizabeth had been tortured for hours prior to her death. This was false information, yet the police allowed these reports to be circulated so they could conceal her true cause of death. By February 1st, the Los Angeles Daily News said that the case had run into a stone wall and that there were no new leads. The Examiner still ran stories on the investigation and murder, which was front page news for 35 days after the body was discovered. Captain Jack Donahue had told the press that he thought the murder had happened in some remote building or shack on the outskirts of LA, and that the body had been transported into the city. Based on the precision of the cuts and dissection, they thought the murderer may have been a doctor, surgeon, or somebody with medical knowledge. By the spring of 1947, her murder was a cold case. Sergeant Finnis Brown blamed the press for compromising the investigation. Over the years, amateur sleuths and detectives alike have tried to solve the case of Elizabeth Short. It is still unsolved as far as the police are concerned, but as we will discuss next week, one man believes he has cracked the case wide open. Your thoughts?
I'm getting heart sick hearing all these cases where they're like, evidence got ruined, evidence got compromised. It honestly makes me think back then the police were very corrupt.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it.
Like, I mean...
I mean, yeah, it's one thing. It's... I don't know. They're so... It being, what? The fingerprints got compromised in transit.
In transit.
Yeah. That's very vague because there's so many things that could have happened.
Did he spill his coffee and donuts on it? What?
That could have happened.
I mean, I get back then, like now you just put it into a computer system and it sends it through. You can't really screw it up. You still can, but it's not as easy. Back then, right. They had to fly out from California to probably New York, wherever the FBI office was.
Yeah,
wherever their headquarters was.
I get that it was actually on a piece of paper and had to be transported, but yeah. I'm sure it wasn't his first time transporting fingerprints.
Oh no, like I feel like a case that high profile, that big, would not have been given to a rookie to handle the fingerprints.
No. The worst part is the case just got bigger as the mystery grew, but that's how it all started.
Yeah. And like, do we really think the guy who killed himself did it?
No.
I don't think so. I think he was just trying to get his 15 minutes of fame.
Yep. That's something I don't understand. So many of these cases that we've done that are unsolved, these people coming forward, confessing to it, even killing themselves, confessing to it, and they didn't do it.
No.
I'm like, why? I don't understand.
The only thing I think of is for the attention. I mean, like, but in that aspect, it's like you've killed yourself, so you're not going to get the attention. Other than, hey, this person says he did it and then killed himself, so he must be guilty.
Yeah. If he actually killed himself. Yeah. He could have done, like...
proof. Did they find a body?
Nope.
They found clothes with a note.
Yep.
Even after the attempted suicide, apparently there was more stuff that I heard, so it's just like, well, okay.
Also, that's a really freaking gruesome killing.
That was my other thing, like, if this was a one-time thing, that was brutal.
Okay, if it was a one-time thing, who's to say they didn't do it again and just didn't find the remains?
Yeah.
Like, maybe they learned from hers. But to be that brutal... I feel like they've had to have killed before.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you don't just say, wake up a morning, oh, I want to kill somebody in the most brutal way possible. I mean, I guess you can, but I mean, for how clean it was, so to speak.
Yeah.
And how well done it was. They had to have done it before. Or been planning it for a very long time.
Or it had a lot of time to think about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, I do believe the cops were on the right track with thinking it was some sort of medical professional.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Coroner.
Or the butler.
Or the butler.
No. When you said, found a suicide note, I was like, how the elf do they think that was a suicide? And then he said in Mills Code, I was like, okay. I was like.
Yeah.
Yeah, let me tell you, I just cut myself in half, pulled my intestines out. Put them under me. Did all this other stuff. Yeah, okay.
Wiggled my top part just a hair this way. Yeah.
Totally a suicide. Oh, lordy.
The whole, the cuts of the mouth.
That's what's so creepy.
Yeah.
I mean, all is really creepy and disturbing, but I mean, that just, something about that is just,
I know.
Next level creepy. Makes me think of that Japanese ghost with the smiling face.
Yeah. I also wonder if that's meant to send a message.
Well, it had something to do with, like, her beauty. Like, they thought maybe she was too vain or something.
I mean, like, for it to be that brutal, I mean, it was personal, I feel like. I feel like maybe she had a stalker and she just didn't know it.
I mean, that's possible.
I mean, like, I feel like it was a very... To be that level of brutality and to mutilate her face like that, I personally think it was personal.
Was it ever released about drugs in her system or if she was a smoker?
No, nothing was said. They just said she had very decayed teeth. So.
Yeah, that's what I was leading to.
And back then, people had, you know, as big as
I know, but teeth, even so. Still. I mean, there's reasons it's unsolved.
One of the biggest cold cases.
Yeah.
Do you think things would have gone differently for her if she didn't go to live with her dad?
Honestly, maybe. I don't know. Anything's possible. I mean, of course, if she stayed living in Massachusetts for her whole life, it probably wouldn't have happened. But she was
young, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was just
in her early... Younger than you thought she was?
Yeah, younger than I thought she was, yeah.
But, like, it's one of those things that's, like, are certain people meant to have things happen to them, regardless of where they are. I've been watching way too much Bones and Supernatural and stuff. So my brain's like, what did you say that?
Any more thoughts on this, the first half?
Do we think it could have been a hired hit?
No, I don't think so. Because like you said, the method, what they did to her body was really personal.
Yes.
Yeah.
As gross as this may sound, it was kind of like a piece of art for them.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah, I definitely think it was somebody who knew her or who stalked her.
Yeah.
On the topic of it being graphic, the whole anal cavity thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Just because that was the way it was doesn't mean...
No, they could have penetrated her with a foreign object.
Yeah.
Which technically, by definition... I think falls in the category of rape, doesn't it?
In my book, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it all goes back to consent. It would
basically be considered rape with a foreign object.
But yeah, I wasn't expecting that when I was writing that up because I hadn't heard that on anything else. And I'm writing all this stuff, the lacerations, and I figured that's where it would end and it gets to that. I'm like, okay, well.
I mean, did they have condoms back? Like, when were condoms invented?
Earlier.
Like, some form of condoms been around for actually quite some time.
Okay, so they would have had something to protect themselves from leaving behind DNA.
Yeah.
If she was raped with his manhood.
And, you know, they said that the newspapers said that she had been tortured for days, but the police didn't believe that was true, but they just let that story happen so that the true cause of death that get out there. And I suppose that had something to do to ensure they caught the real killer, because if the general public doesn't know what the true cause of death was, then a killer would.
Yeah, I don't know.
I feel like, though, she was tortured to a certain extent.
Oh, yeah. I think so, too.
I mean, she might not have been tied up for days, but I don't think the torture is too far-fetched, especially if she was raped.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I mean, considering what the coroner said, cause of death was mostly head injuries.
Yeah.
And...
pick one.
Yeah.
And the only thing he specified that happened post-mortem was the bisection. So we don't know, like, all those other lacerations, she could have been alive for that.
Yeah. There's proof in the tissue and in bones of, like, if that happened post-mortem, pre-mortem, or peri-mortem.
Okay. Theory crafting here. She was with several, from what I understand, either former or current military personnel.
Yeah.
Relationship-wise. Could this have been her torture, her suspected torture and or killing may have been a way to get information? They may have thought she had something. Whoever they may be.
There again, with this case, anything is possible.
Yeah.
Because they literally have the bare minimum of information.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I do know, like, she couch surfed and stuff like that. I don't think she had very many homes. She stayed with a lot of friends and might have gotten in with the wrong crowd.
I mean, and any one of those friends could have actually been killer.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't sound like she really knew these people that well.
Yeah, she was in L.A. for, like, just a few years, if that. Mm-hmm. But back on, like, you said if she had went to live with her, if she hadn't have went to live with her father. And I just, on that, I just wonder, and maybe this is what you were getting at, is if she hadn't have went to live with her father, would she have still had the urge to become an actress and move to L.A.?
Yes, that's where I kind of was headed and my brain went, pew! I mean, who knows? I mean, there are people who live around us that say, yeah, I want to be an actress. And they try to get on stage here and then work their way up, like New York or L.A.
Yeah.
But, like, I wonder, like, if her life would have took a different direction entirely.
Yeah.
Being away from the influence of the Hollywood light, so to speak.
Yeah. And the fact that she was so young and probably pretty impressionable given that she grew up in a small town.
Oh, yeah.
I think they took advantage of that.
I think so, too. They really do.
That's it for this week's episode. Check us out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Stay spooky, everybody, and see you next time.